You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business by Alex Ferrari. For a free copy of the audiobook, head over to www.filmbizbook.com.
The Director Series is made possible by the support of our subscribers on Special. Subscribe today at special.tv/The Director Series and gain access to exclusive full-length Director Series episodes and other bonus content, ad-free. Welcome to the Director Series podcast, a show dedicated to deconstructing the work of some of cinema's most celebrated and influential film directors. I'm your host, Cameron Bile.
Kubrick largely made his career out of confounding expectations. Each work in his filmography belongs firmly within its genre, yet at the same time also acts as a blatant subversion of said genre. Paths of Glory turned the romantic war epic into an ethics debate. Dr. Strangelove twisted the conventions of the sex comedy by giving it cataclysmic end-of-the-world stakes. 2001 traded the cheesy pulp tropes of mid-century science fiction for a sweeping sense of ominous wonder towards creation and the unknown. After the highly controversial, ultraviolet A Clockwork Orange, Kubrick again surprised the film community by swinging another 180 degrees in his choice for a follow-up. A stuffy costume drama based on an obscure 1844 picaresque novel written by William Makepeace Thackeray, entitled The Luck of Barry Lyndon. Knowing what we do of Kubrick's career up to this point, however, the selection of Thackeray's novel isn't surprising at all. Kubrick had spent years exhaustively researching the life and times of French Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte for an epic film that fell apart shortly before cameras could roll, forcing him to channel his energies instead into A Clockwork Orange. A film adaptation of The Luck of Barry Lyndon afforded Kubrick the opportunity to repurpose the mountains of research he had amassed for Napoleon, given the similar time era and cultures depicted in both works. Working from his own script, and with his brother-in-law Jan Harlan as an executive producer, Kubrick set about making Barry Lyndon, an oversized production that took 2 years to film and endured no less than 2 shutdowns as its budget swelled to $11 million. Despite Kubrick's great difficulty in getting the film made, Barry Lyndon's mixing of old-school costume dramaturgy and the filmmaking techniques of the New Wave to convey the misadventures of a charismatic charlatan results in one of the best films of the 1970s, and arguably the finest film of its illustrious director's career.
How do you do? I'm Captain Feeney.
Captain Feeney?
Captain Feeney at your service.
The Captain Feeney?
None other. May I introduce you to my son, Seamus?
How do you do?
How do you do?
And now I'm afraid we must get on to the more regrettable state of our brief acquaintance. Turn around. And keep your hands high above your head, please.
During this time, actor Ryan O'Neill was at the peak of his career, and his performance as the titular Barry Lyndon remains perhaps the very tip of that peak. As Lyndon rises from rags to riches, only to fall back to rags once more, O'Neill applies a composed nuance to each stage of the journey. Lyndon's decades-long growth from stubborn, idealistic lad to disdainful, hedonistic adult is given a convincing sense of the passage of time by O'Neill, who excels at projecting a world-weary countenance onto his boyish face. For Lady Lyndon, Kubrick looked to model Maurice Berenson, who isn't required to do much besides standing around in a silent, statuesque fashion. However, Berenson imbues the character with a layer of fundamental sadness, masked by stoic composure that serves the story well as it draws to a close. When she signs off on an alimony check for her disgraced lout of a husband, she pauses and looks up for only the briefest of moments, but in that moment she lives a lifetime. Supporting performers of note include Leon Vitali as Lord Bullingdon, who would later go on to become Kubrick's personal assistant and casting director on his final two films, as well as two veteran Kubrick performers on their second tour of duty, Patrick McGee and Philip Stone. McGee, who played the crippled political dissident in A Clockwork Orange, appears in Barry Lyndon under an eye patch and a pound of white makeup as the aristocratic libertine Chevalier de Balabari. Stone, who likewise appeared in A Clockwork Orange as Malcolm McDowell's father, plays Graham, a meek banker for Lady Lyndon and an unexpected conspirator against Barry.
No, thank you, Mrs. Barry.
Barry Lyndon is widely regarded as one of the most beautiful films ever made, and for good reason. Working once again with cinematographer John Alcott, Kubrick puts his prior experiments with natural light to masterful use in rendering the pre-electric world of Barry Lyndon. Kubrick's visual presentation differs radically from his previous works, in that he presents scenes as carefully staged tableaus, expertly composed to provide staggering degrees of depth, resembling the paintings of 18th century artists like Thomas Gainsborough. The romantic feel of Kubrick's compositions are further emphasized by the use of soft focus, which diffuses the frame's highlights and adds to the film's sense of Baroque glamour. Kubrick's subjects and locales, impeccably designed with a careful eye to authentic period detail by Dr. Strangelove's production designer Ken Adam, are lit almost entirely with existing natural light, an aesthetic choice that really accentuates the red and blue pops of color from British and Prussian military uniforms against the golden earth tones of pastoral England. Kubrick was so intent on creating an authentic pre-industrial world that, in the process, he managed to pioneer an entirely new technology that would change filmmaking forever. Working with NASA, Kubrick developed a specialized lens that could capture a beautiful exposure using only a few candles. Many nocturnal scenes in Barry Lyndon are lit entirely by candlelight, and the organic feeling of these scenes would be highly influential in the continued development of low-light technology, while its groundbreaking use in Barry Lyndon would become one of the cornerstones of the film's legacy. Kubrick's supreme confidence in his mastery of visual language is on full, flagrant display in Barry Lyndon. The fact that he presents his scenes almost entirely in masters while rarely cutting away to other coverage speaks to the sheer audaciousness of Kubrick's vision and technical prowess. The effect is staggering and stately, a reflection of the pompous rigidity of his subjects. In the hands of a lesser filmmaker, this approach would be endlessly boring. But Kubrick incorporates the unconventional filmmaking techniques of New Hollywood, techniques he himself helped to popularize, in order to breathe immediacy and energy into the proceedings. While there are a few characteristic tracking shots, as well as several instances of handheld documentary-style photography, Barry Lyndon mostly plays out in the aforementioned master tableaus, aided by the frequent use of zoom lenses to zero in on a particular detail within the scene, or vice versa. Kubrick uses this conceit repeatedly, creating a hypnotic mood that pulls us deeper and deeper into his Baroque vision. At this point in his career, Kubrick had fully embraced the use of classical music over an original score, and to this end, he enlisted Leonard Rosenman to create new arrangements of famous works by Bach, Vivaldi, Mozart, and Schubert, in addition to several Irish folk songs.
The object of Barry's attention, and the cause of all his early troubles, was his cousin, Nora Brady by name.
Yes, Brian.
Will you buy me a horse?
Will I buy you a horse?
Barry Lyndon's most memorable piece of music, Handel's Sarabande, was reappropriated as a theme song of sorts, thundering along as Barry's fate unfolds.
I am the resurrection and the life of the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead.
While on the surface, the musical character of Kubrick's classical selection seemed quite appropriate to the images they accompany, he nonetheless uses it subversively. The operatic Sarabande march in particular suggests the trials and tribulations of a great king, someone like, say, Napoleon Bonaparte.
Well then, there's nothing else for it.
However, Kubrick bestows this theme not on a king or emperor, but on a peasant who lived large for a while and ultimately died as a penniless nobody. The sense of history and importance that Sarabande conveys runs counter to Barry Lyndon's actual life, reflecting only his supreme narcissism. The Despite its regal, stuffy aesthetic, Barry Lyndon contains all the visual hallmarks of its subversive maverick director.
As he rode away, Barry felt once more that he was in his proper sphere, and determined never again to fall from the rank of a gentleman.
The combination of one-point perspective compositions and an omniscient narrator places the audience at an observant remove from the action. The story's examination of royal aristocracy in its heyday allows for the indulgence of Kubrick's fascinations with Baroque architecture, as well as the ineffectual pageantry and customs of the time. Lyndon's stint in the military also provides an opportunity for Kubrick to further explore violence in the circumstance of warfare, specifically the strangely self-sacrificial rituals of battle in the pre-industrial era. In those days, antiquated notions of honor and valor were attached to leaving oneself open and exposed to enemy fire, as if taking cover to protect oneself was an act of cowardice. This could be seen in the gorgeously colored and decorated, yet highly visible uniforms worn by soldiers, which certainly made them appear as magnificent gentlemen, but had the unfortunate side effect of advertising their location to their enemies from a great distance. The style of combat reflected this as well, with armies advancing on each other while politely taking turns in their exchange of fire, effectively leaving the entire front line vulnerable and willingly exposed to a volley of musket balls. Under Kubrick's hand, these notions of civilized warfare among gentlemen become highly curious and ironic. This idea is echoed on a smaller scale in the sequences where Barry participates in turn-based duels. In the world of Barry Lyndon, violence has been institutionalized by the civilized as a means to resolve disputes or inflict disciplinary punishment. But in the process, it's lost the emotion and intimacy that makes it meaningful. Instead of violence being a reflection of our inhumanity to our fellow man, it is violence itself that has become inhuman. Kubrick's body of work is held in such high regard today that it's easy to forget the release of his films were regularly met with something of a mixed bag in terms of reception. They were, understandably, ahead of their time, and many people didn't quite know what to make of them. Many outright hated them, but nonetheless they knew that they also had to respect them. This can certainly be said of Barry Lyndon, whose release was met with modest box office success and mixed critical reception. A 3-hour-plus non-epic about the 18th-century European aristocracy may not have been everyone's cup of tea, but damned if they didn't respect it. And respect it they did, all the way to the Oscars, where the film took home golden statues for Alcott's cinematography, Adams's production design, Rosenman's score, and even the costumes, while Kubrick himself was nominated for Best Picture, Director, and Screenplay. Kubrick's achievement here is nothing less than masterful, and while he would never get to make his long gestating Napoleon film, he was able to channel that passion into making Barry Lyndon a stone-cold masterpiece, one that very well could have stood head and shoulders above Napoleon had he made it. In a filmography composed almost entirely of masterpieces, Barry Lyndon stands out as quite possibly the finest of the bunch.
Thank you for listening to the Director Series. For a deeper dive into your favorite filmmakers, go to www.directorseries.net. The Director Series is made possible in large part by our generous supporters on Patreon. Please visit us at patreon.com/directorseries to see how your contribution enables the continued production of video essays and text articles on your favorite contemporary and classic film directors. Thank you.